out current trends, revive forgotten traditions, and of course, we're going to share a recipe with you. Through the ages, the Christmas dinner has brought us all together. Though the menus and merriment may have changed, the birth of Christ is still the reason for the season. Join me, Chef John Falls, and Kathy Kaufman of the Culinary Historians of New York as we talk about historic Christmas feasts on Stirring It Up next. But first, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Barbara Klein. The White House is warning South Sudan's leaders that U.S. support is at risk if they don't resolve their differences through dialogue. This is a battle between the country's president and vice president threatens to trigger a civil war. NPR's Gregory Warner reports four U.S. military personnel were injured in the violence today when small arms fire hit their aircraft.
The servicemen were airlifted to Nairobi for treatment. The U.S. military says the men were on a mission to evacuate American citizens. They aborted the mission when they came under fire. Hundreds of people have been killed in South Sudan this week since an alleged attempted coup pit the country's two most powerful political leaders from the country's two largest tribes against one another. President Obama sent a small military contingent of 45 troops into the country with a mission to protect U.S. citizens and U.S. property. Gregory Warner, NPR News, Nairobi.
In Scotland, London, and the U.S. today, commemorations marking 25 years since a Pan Am flight over Lockerbie, Scotland, exploded, killing 270 people in the air and on the ground. At Lockerbie Cemetery today, overcast skies and a solemn mood, as Larry Miller reports.
A Lockerbie clergyman spoke of evil since the Pan Am bombing, September 11th, London 7-7, Madrid, Bali, what he called the terrorist's roll call, representing the U.S. Homeland Security official Craig Lines.
Families, friends, it is you who bear the heaviest of hearts. While our words can do little to repair the damage caused by this act of terrorism, we offer them with hope.
Lines insisted the fight against terrorism must continue.
We owe that to each of you.
After a moment of silence, a bagpiper played. Flowers and wreaths were placed at the foot of a stone monument to those who were killed. For NPR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
National Intelligence Director James Clapper has declassified more NSA documents. They include Obama and Bush administration court filings, asking a federal judge to continue to keep details about internet and phone surveillance programs secret. They also provide insight into how the programs got initial approval. But the documents are heavily redacted and offer little new information. The government is gradually declassifying some NSA documents under a court order. Consumers who used their Chase debit cards at Target are facing another blow after Target said computer hackers stole data from as many as 40 million credit and debit cards this week. J.P. Morgan Chase says it's limiting the amount of cash customers can take out at ATMs if their cards are at risk. Meanwhile, Target is offering a 10% discount to all of its customers this weekend, trying to lure them back after the hacking. This is NPR. Another huge storm system is moving across the middle of the country from the southwest to New England. It's bringing freezing rain, ice, and snow as holiday travelers hit the roads or try to take to the skies. It's also bringing a heat wave to parts of the east. Wildlife officials in Utah say 12 bald eagles have died from an unexplained disease, and they're scrambling to determine what caused it. NPR's Howard Berkus reports dead eagles are being discovered daily.
Bald eagle carcasses and sick and dying birds have been discovered in the region surrounding the Great Salt Lake, which attracts one of the largest wintering populations of eagles in the lower 48 states. Most of the bald eagles that have died showed symptoms of a neurological disorder, including head tremors and partial paralysis. That had wildlife officials considering lead poisoning from shotgun pellets in animals eaten by the eagles. but the numbers of sick and dead birds has officials thinking that infection or disease is to blame, including avian cholera, a persistent problem around the lake. Bald eagle remains have been sent to wildlife health labs for study. Howard Berkus, NPR News, Salt Lake City.
Two astronauts are safely back in the International Space Station after a 5.5-hour spacewalk. They managed to complete the first steps in fixing the outpost's cooling system. Unlike the last spacewalk in July, NASA says no leaks were detected in the astronauts' spacesuits. At least one more spacewalk is planned to replace a pump. The operation is being carried out because one of the station's two cooling systems had to be shut down, and the remaining system can't support the U.S. side of the station. The Russian side is cooled by a separate system. I'm Barbara Klein, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Kresge Foundation, expanding opportunities in America's cities at kresge.org.
For the finest in classic ska, rock steady, rockers, DJ, dance hall, and dub, it's Jamon. Cecil here, bringing you Southwest Louisiana's longest running reggae tradition, Jamon. Jamon, Sunday nights from 9 to 11 p.m. or Saturday mornings from 1 to 3 a.m. and streaming live anytime at krvs.org.
Chef John Falls welcoming you to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. From the swamps and bayous of South Louisiana, thanks for joining us in our little piece of culinary heaven where good cooking is just a way of life. Mornings begin here with a roux simmering in a cast iron pot, and our evenings end with thoughts of what we're going to cook tomorrow. All right, everybody, welcome to the kitchen table. It's so nice to have all of you here with us today. We appreciate it so very much. We know you have a lot of things on your plate. We know you have a lot of places to go. So thanks for having a cup of coffee with us today. And I'd like to begin by welcoming Miss Shelley York, our executive producer. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well.
Well, you know, your birthday is right around the corner here.
Look, I hate to tell you.
Yeah, I missed it.
You missed it.
I missed it.
I assumed that there were going to be gifts today.
Slama, we missed her birthday.
Ooh, in the doghouse.
But I knew it was around this time.
Mm-hmm.
Because
You're only a day late.
Every year at this time, you know, you got to remember where you got to get a birthday present, mm-hmm. and then you got to get a Christmas present. She's rather picky.
Yeah, rather picky.
This is the good news. I'm still accepting gifts.
Door's still open.
The door's still open.
See if you can find something there. I can wrap up real fast, okay?
All right.
Anyway, happy birthday.
Thank you so much, sir.
No problem at all. And across the glass wall, of course, Dean Slama, our engineer, keeping us alive and well. Music dynamic in there. How are you doing?
I'm well.
Anyway, y'all, we're coming right into the home stretch. And I know you've been doing a lot of shopping. I mean, I remember right after Thanksgiving, you out there fighting the crowds, unlike me, who just hid away in my garage, you know, to make sure nobody caught me. But anyway, so your shopping's done?
Yeah, for the most part, it's done. But, you know, there's still opportunity for those last-minute sales, of which I don't expect that to be my birthday present. But just for other Christmas shoppers, there's still a couple of sales. And, you know, shopping can be fairly grueling, you know, in the chill, and you know, there's a thrill to it too.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
grueling, it's thrilling, well, fighting for the last towel on the rack.
Well, you know, there's two or three great schools of thought there. You know, some people really thrive at getting out there early and fighting crowds because it's their rendition of Christmas spirit.
Yeah.
You know,
it's a rush.
I'd say it's Christmas spirit for them. Others like to stay as far away from it as possible. Mm-hmm. Which one are you, Slum?
I think I'm the latter.
You're the latter.
Stay in the garage.
Me too. I'm the latter.
But if you had seen some of the nice bargains I got. Oh, you may change your mind.
Yeah, yeah.
And steal.
Some people are out for bargains, huh? Some people are out for bargains. A lot of people are. Anyway, y'all, Christmas is up right around the corner, needless to say. And we should be singing. You know, Catherine Crosby was in visiting.
Yeah, just a few weeks ago.
Yeah, Catherine Crosby, Bing Crosby's wife. And I was thinking about her this morning because she called to say how nice her little birthday party was. Because, you know, it's her birthday a couple of weeks ago.
That's right.
And Catherine flew in from California. And to think that you have the wife of Bing Crosby sitting in
the voice of Christmas.
Yeah, the voice of Christmas sitting right across the table from you. And it's Christmas.
Right. And his children and grandchildren.
Children and grandchildren were all there as well. Fact is, one of Bing's son's daughter may actually be looking at my culinary school.
Oh, no.
Goes to show you how smart those Crosbys are. Well, she wants to be a chef, and that's great news, huh?
That's right.
Imagine that, Bing Crosby's granddaughter.
Goodness
gracious. So you're dreaming of a white Christmas?
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, yep.
I mean, you have to love Bing Crosby's. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. And it's great to hear Catherine tell the story of when he recorded It Was a Hot, Hot Day in California. You know, there are a lot of great Christmas carols. What about Good King Wenceslas?
I'm not familiar with that one.
Come on.
Wenceslas, where's he from?
Well, he's not from down the bayou for sure. But, you know, it's songs like that and different carols that really kind of make you think of the food as well. The big dining hall strung with holly and evergreen garland and those long, heavy oak tables lined with different foods and revelers sitting all around singing and toasting. Doesn't that sound great? Doesn't it sound like we should be in England?
Well, that's kind of like at my mayor's house. Not like my mayor's house on Sunday.
I guess it was.
And a big Cajun family. It definitely was a rendition of those big tables. Anyway, and eating too. Eating, y'all. Eating. Yes, I can envision that. Christmas marks the end of the Advent fast.
Were we supposed to fast?
Well, you don't have to worry about it now. It's the end of the coming around to the end of that. And the end of hunting season. So those tables would have been laden with all sorts of game. You know, that's why you hear about the Christmas goose and a Christmas carol and the venison and meat pies and puddings and stews and breads. All the braised dishes that we do, the gumbos, just fall into those categories. And don't forget the dried fruits and sweets. I mean, all the fruit cakes and things like that. And in those days, the servants would be a herald. We didn't have service, but we herald my mayor. You know,
so, poor my mayor.
Poor my mayor. And into the big hall, the servants would be called in by trumpeters. And Michelle, I want you to have this view of these long jacketed gentlemen and carrying these beautiful big silver trays, held boar's heads and suckling pigs. The stars of the show, the sounds of bells would be ringing, chill in the air, smell of evergreen. Oh, I tell you what, I can...
Christmas is past.
Christmas is past.
Kind of a Dickens Christmas, if you will.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, then as now, there was huge abundance to go around. And depending on the wealth and the generosity of the head of the manor, other lords, peasants, townspeople might be invited to join the feast. We're talking way back, you know. We're talking tradition. Often, though, it was a BYOF invitation. You know what that means? Bring your own food and fuel. Bring your own food and fuel
to come to the party.
For cooking.
Yeah, yeah, to bring your wood and everything else. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely.
I never... Isn't that interesting?
Bring your own firewood.
Yeah, you hear bring your own beverage, but...
Yes.
Well, the idea was back then was not that you were invited to a free party, but you were there to enjoy the communal exchange of food and feasting with friends and, of course, townspeople. And naturally, the lord of the manor, while the Hugh log was burned in this great big fireplace, there was this celebratory feast and gathering happening around the manor.
Of the whole town.
Can you imagine that?
That's awesome to think about. You know, by the 1500s, the Christmas celebration became even more reverent and less bawdy. Edward VI ordered that everyone had to walk to church on Christmas Day. Prior to that, Henry VIII had introduced the Unlawful Games Act, banning all sports on Christmas Day except for archery, because that was part of a strong military.
Well, you know, fortunately, they later added some other games. You know, they wanted to calm Christmas down when you say body. You know, they want.
Yeah.
But fortunately, they later added, you know, like vaulting and leaping to the list of things that they could do. Now, think about that.
You're going to be vaulting.
Lucky for Michelle. Lucky for you and Michelle, a little vaulting and a little leaping could be done.
Yeah.
Lords you know, of leaping.
Yeah,
think about
Lords
that.
Lords of leaping. That's where
well,
it comes
get up
from.
There and leap. Let us see you leap. For a second, and then you get ready to vault.
But you see people hear that song on the days of Christmas and Lords are leaping. They don't know what you're talking about. Now they do, because it was Henry VIII that allowed them to leap again. Huh?
You know, a common dish of that time was the Tudor Christmas pie.
Henry VIII, there he is.
This was a pigeon inside a partridge, inside a chicken, inside a goose, inside a turkey, then put into a pastry.
Yeah.
Huh. Makes turducken sound pretty easy. How in the world would you name that?
Then it could be put inside of a pig and inside of an ox. I mean, you know, hey, look, these were great peace motifs, they call them as they were. I was partial, you know, when I discovered the cockatrice. Now, cockatrice. Yeah. They used to create these masterful pieces for the table. They thought, anyway, now remember, this is the Renaissance, right? I mean,
right.
You're talking about the 15, 1600s. And they were always trying to outdo everybody. A cockatrice was two animals that had been slaughtered for the centerpiece of the table, like, say, a roasted pig like we have today, or, say, a deep-fried turkey, right? You got these two animals. Well, what they would do, the cooks of those days, would split it in half and take the head of the pig and the front legs. Cut it in half. And then they would stuff all of that and sew it to the back of a turkey. So you had the front of a pig and the back legs of the turkey. And then on the other side of the table, you'd have the head and wings of the turkey sewed to the back of the pig.
Oh, good grief.
Oh, yeah, all these weird things. I mean, it was all about who could outdo who and how wild you could get and how big the party could be and how extravagant the food. And, I mean, this was just an example of it. And these are very mythical-looking creatures, and it was just associated with that time. But you can imagine, wow, that would look pretty weird to walk up that table and see the head of a pig sewed to the back of a turkey.
Yeah.
Right?
Christmas celebration reached a high point, actually, during this period. But the Puritan Reformation was right around the corner.
Here they come. Here they come.
Yep. Oliver Cromwell viewed the revelry as too much of a throwback to the pagan celebrations of the ancient Roman Saturnalia. For about 20 years, attempts were made to squash all forms of Christmas celebrations, including an edict banning Christmas Day Mass. Mincemeat pies, that's, you know, with the ground parts of lamb and beef, currants, raisins, spices. The mincemeat pies, baked into a crust that resembled Christ's sepulcher, were outlawed as idolatry.
Wow.
Now, we're talking about Christmas, and that was outlawed as idolatry. But the baking continued as the renamed Christmas pie was formed into a different shape. It was seen as treasonous to cook roasts or any type of meal that resembled earlier feasts.
Well, you know, Cromwell was quite a character, you know.
Ooh, goodness.
He was. He died in 1658, and of course, he's even today reveled as one of the greatest all-time leaders of England, if not the greatest. And when Charles II took the throne after Cromwell died, ballads were sung all over England like this, you know, these holidays we briskly drink, all mirth we will devise, no treason we will speak or think, then bring us brave minced pies. In other words, heck on Cromwell. Cromwell was also known for his sayings. I should mention real fast, one of my favorite. I've always loved his sayings. On his deathbed, he said, "I'd rather have a plain, unbathed, russet-coated captain that knows what he's fighting for and loved that he knew it than that of a gentleman who, in fact, was nothing more." Cromwell. Anyway, all kind of roasts and mincemeat pies and fruitcakes, guys. Hey, look, we're at Christmas. We're at Christmas.
We're talking about traditional Christmas today.
We're talking about tradition, and y'all, we have a great guest coming. We have great music, so don't y'all dare go anywhere, and I think we might even be cooking a little something, huh?
Oh, I hope so. I hope so.
Y'all, we'll see you back in just a minute.
Hope you're going to stoke the fires.
Going to see you back in just a minute.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas.
Greetings, I'm Jake Hebert.
And I'm Adam Chouard. Join us every Friday at midnight for the Sound Club radio program.
Your home for left-field pop gems from today to yesteryear.
Here on 88.7 FM, KRVS.
Hi, I'm Pete Bergeron. If your day starts early, like mine does, let's spend it together with Cajun music from 5 to 7 a.m. here at Public Radio for Acadiana, KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
Have a holly jolly Christmas. It's the best time of the year. I don't know if there'll be snow.
All right, everybody, welcome back to Stirring It Up, the best tasting food and culture show on radio. And Michelle, today we're very excited because we're talking about historic Christmas celebrations, historic food as well. And we have a fabulous guest with us as well. So why don't you go ahead and let's just get into it. We don't want to miss a minute here.
Absolutely. Kathy Kaufman is our guest today. Kathy is an author, professional chef, and she is chairman of the Culinary Historians of New York. Since the early 90s, Kathy has immersed herself in the culture surrounding foods of earlier times by studying, by teaching, lecturing on the history and origins of food. She just completed her graduate coursework in food studies at New York University. Doesn't that sound incredible?
Oh, it does.
If I weren't already in school, I'd enroll. Kathy received her honors diploma from Peter Kump's New York Cooking School, now the Institute of Culinary Education. She's lectured on culinary history at universities and has been a consultant in the area of historic dining to museums and cultural foundations throughout New York. She was a senior editor of the Oxford Encyclopedia of Food and Drink in America, a phenomenal series, and she is the author of Cooking in Ancient Civilizations. Needless to say, she's made appearances on PBS, the History Channel, Food Network, Public Radio, and she's written numerous articles on dining and food of the past. Does she sound like a kindred spirit or what?
Sounds like you want to go spend the weekend.
Could we go see Kathy Kaufman in New York? Kathy, welcome to Stirring It Up. We are delighted to have you with us today.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I am thrilled to be here because I just love talking and sharing about historical food.
Where did your interest for historical food come from? When did that develop?
I started becoming interested in historical food in the mid-90s. Full disclosure, I was a history major in college back in the dark ages, but people didn't talk about food as part of history at that point. It was a lot of the, great men and big wars and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But in the mid-90s, I was cooking professionally, and I was also starting to teach a little bit at Peter Kump's, and people said, we need to expand our curriculum. If you could make your dream course, what would you do? And I had on my bookshelf Madeline Kosman's Fabulous Feasts, which was one of the first food histories out there that was really accessible to, a broad public. I started reading that, and I said, let's do a medieval dinner. And, they looked at me like I was kind of crazy. But the director of education said, we'll try it. We'll see if anybody signs up for it. The class sold out, and I started doing the research, and, I was off to the races at that point. It was just so fascinating to be able to get that window into another time and place with that very visceral taste reaction of knowing this is different, but it's fascinating.
That's right, and that is a fantastic book. I love that book, Fabulous Feasts. Now, you're chairman of the Culinary Historians of New York, and I know in New Orleans, We have a small culinary historian organization that John and I have been involved with periodically through the years. But tell us about the New York organization and the mission there.
Well, we are the second oldest culinary history organization in the U.S. Boston beats us out by 1 year. We were formed in 1985, and our mission is basically to share information about historic foodways, how people ate in the past, and how that influences the way we eat now and into the future. So we have monthly programs that are open to the public. They have different academics coming, different chefs coming, and they talk about whatever theme is of interest to them. We just had a program recently that was on medieval pasta in 12th century Italy, which, you know, it's absolutely wonderful. And we actually made some medieval recipes for pasta. There are some that are around that go back to the 13th and 14th centuries. So we weren't quite as early as the speaker was talking about, but we did have some authentic pasta recipes from Italy in the 14th century. We also have a scholarship that we award, and I have to give a shout-out to the Julia Child Foundation for helping us and supporting us with grants for that scholarship for scholars to research areas in culinary history. And we also have what we call the Amelia Award, which is acknowledging lifetime achievement in culinary history. So we feel sort of the Oscar of culinary history, and we're pretty proud of that.
In fact, I think, was Jan Langoni one of your recipients?
Absolutely. She was the recipient, I think, 2 years ago. And part of what the award recognizes is not only incredible scholarship, because Jan is an amazing scholar of American culinary history, but there's also kind of a generosity give back aspect to our recipients. Jan donated her amazing library, so we really like to point out and honor the people who have made research possible for us and for future generations, and Jan certainly is one of the folks who has done that.
We had her on the radio show a few weeks ago, in fact, talking about historic cookbooks and collecting and that kind of thing. And she's been a long-time friend of John's. And I told her she's one of my best friends that I've never met in person.
Well, she was wonderful. She came to New York to receive the award and gave us just a spectacular illustrated lecture with all of her wonderful historical pamphlets. She was talking about community cookbooks. It was such a smart lecture and so enjoyable that we just felt so honored that she would come and be part of our family.
She's such a great gift to the industry, and I started calling upon her so many years ago, just seeking out a particular book, because I started to get interested also in what did we eat and where did it come from. And she was such a great asset. And Kathy, I should mention that looking at your bio, I know that this is a second career for you. You were, I understand, an attorney before you ventured into food. I think of so many of us who made career changes that eventually brought us to the place we love so much, myself included. Although I come from a Cajun family where cooking was such a way of life, I would have never dreamed of making a career out of it. What prompted you, just for our listeners? I think people are always so interested in how people got to where they are today. You are a practicing attorney, you ventured into food, and now you have such a great resume. What prompted your change?
Part of it was getting a kitchen in New York that was of reasonable size, so I could actually do a little bit of cooking in the kitchen. Manhattan apartments are notoriously small, but when my husband and I married, we had an apartment that had what was, by New York standards, a nice-sized kitchen, and I started just kind of puttering around. I had never really cooked before, unlike so many people in the food industry. The family kitchen was not a big thing in my background. My mother didn't like to cook. And what I discovered was that in cooking, you had a product at the end of the day, and there was something extraordinarily rewarding about having that product that you could share with people, make people happy, unlike practicing law, where I was a litigator. So you would submit papers to the court, and 18 months later, you might get a decision. And at that point, it was like, who cares? That was 18 months ago. So I just found as I was going through, I was becoming increasingly obsessed with cooking. I was at the kind of the right place at the right time. This was in the late 1980s. So food was becoming much more on everybody's radar. The Food Network had not yet been founded, but there was still quite a buzz about food and cooking. And I kind of caught the wave just as food was really starting to become respectable for people to do. I know when I told my mother I was going to cooking school, she was pretty horrified. after having, gone to law school, and I practiced law for a decade, but she finally came around.
I bet, Michelle and I spend so much time talking about origins of food and origin of food ways, etc. And we talked about the changes earlier in the show today in food norms from ancient to medieval times. Is this when food started to resemble more of what we eat today? And if so, what accounted for that? At what point did we get to a place where we could see the foods that we're eating now starting to emerge?
That is such a fabulous and difficult question to answer, because there are different answers depending upon what sorts of foods we're looking at. I could point out recipes in the ancient Roman literature for things like an olive relish, a tapenade, that are virtually identical to what we would have today. So there's some things that have a 2,000-year-old pedigree, if not longer. Then there are a lot of other things that we need to look at industrial changes. So you're looking at really the 19th century, both for the industry and for changes in the way we present food at table. And that, to me, is one of the most important distinctions. Prior to about the 19th century, if you are a wealthy person, you would have a huge variety of dishes served to you at a nice dinner. Probably not every meal, but the wealthier you were, the more variety you had. With the 19th century, things start to become a bit more streamlined, and it's really by the late 19th century that we start seeing meals developed as that, center of the plate meat or protein plus two veg on the side, and have what we consider sort of the standard meal pattern. You can look at different points in history. You can look at the Columbian Exchange, mm-hmm. when, obviously all the New World foods go back to the Old World, and Old World foods come into what would become the American food system. So that's another point at which things start to look a lot more like what we expect on the plate nowadays. It's a constant evolution. It's not one of these nice linear progressions. You really need to kind of pick and decide, what do I want to focus on in terms of seeing how foods evolve?
Earlier, I loved what you said, Kathy, about so much of history is centered around wars and dictators and different leaders. And as much as I love history, I truly have a newfound love of history when you start looking at the social aspects and the food aspects. One of our great friends who passed away a few years ago, Michael Badaberry from Food Arts Magazine, I'll never forget when he wrote in an inscription, it was like from one social historian to another. That was like the greatest thing he could have ever said. And what a true statement. Food and feasts are wealths of information for all about food and culture. You kind of touched on this, but these events really are kind of cultural barometers, are they not?
Oh, absolutely. I think one of the great things about looking at a feast is it can so often tell you what the host and the participants are aspiring to. This is how they want to present themselves through food. You look at some of the great medieval feasts with not only the huge variety of dishes, but a lot of the very decorative foods and the display foods that were part of the feast. You would have in a great medieval feast, what were called the subtleties, which are these often pastry sculptures that were actually telling a story, and they would be paraded around the dining hall for everyone to see. There's a favorite one that I remember in a description. It was a wedding feast, and they made from marzipan and pastry an image of a very pregnant woman going into labor.
Oh, my.
And, it just tells you right there that this was a marriage that was certainly designed to keep the family line going. And that was part of the entire purpose of this big celebration. So I think these feasts do give us the image of how we want to present ourselves and how we want to be seen by others.
Kathy, you know, here in Louisiana, I mean, you know, we pride ourselves in not only a love of culture, but a love of cuisine and keeping both alive from the traditional aspect. And now I was reminded yesterday in a conversation with the family and friends, it's hunting season here, and the hunters out in the hunting camps, and men, women, children, they're all part of this great activity. I was reading something this morning about Pennsylvania getting all involved in the beginning of this gigantic hunting season that is now a social season, that people are coming together to keep these hunting traditions alive. And yet so much of our early cooking, so much of our early food history revolved around the same thing, the great hunts and the great parties of the lords and kings, etc. And I'm viewing these simple, and I use that word loosely, Cajun families and traditions of the suckling pig and the whole roasted deer and the turducken and the huge pots of gumbo that become more creative every year by my grandmother did this and my great-grandmother did this and we made our own sausages. Do you see any revitalization across the country of a desire to keep your foodways alive from the more modern aspect? I'm talking about from the late 1800s. Is there anywhere else that you're seeing this? In Louisiana, it's almost a religion. And that's what I guess that makes things so interesting here. But do you see a lot of that going on anywhere in the country?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I can speak about my own environment in New York and the Hudson Valley. And the revitalization of the local dairy industry with lots of cheese making. You know, apples are a huge crop in New York, and there are folks who are making Applejack, artisanal versions, Calvados. Certainly there are some of the historic houses that are doing lots of different demonstrations about their traditional Dutch food ways. And that's starting to permeate into, you know, restaurant culture to some extent. And then you also have things, you know, like the slow food movement, which is very active in New York. And we are looking to maintain these very traditional food preparation techniques. Brooklyn, New York, is actually a hotbed right now of artisanal preparation. So there are people doing all sorts of different pickles. There are brewers and distillers who are using historical recipes. So I think there is a huge, huge interest in doing that. I think the one thing that might make it a little bit different from what you describe in Louisiana is that this tends to be something that is more available to the affluent sections of the New York food culture. While certainly in upstate, we've got plenty of folks who are hunting and doing it on a subsistence basis. You know, deer season just finished and the wild turkey season just finished, and there are plenty of people who are doing that. I think the real conscious effort to look back at our history has tended to be for the more affluent, at least in New York.
I got some pictures, which, of course, social media and everybody shooting pictures and sharing them with us. I got an interesting photograph yesterday from the swamps of Louisiana and a camp of people I didn't really know. They sent me this beautiful picture of, I guess, the father, the mother, a few aunts and uncles, but these young children, and I'm talking about 8, 9, 10, no more for sure, preteen. And they're making sausages and they're stuffing casings. And I thought to myself, wow, thank God. I mean, we're keeping the richest part of our regional cuisines alive. And not only that, the storytelling, the writing down of recipes, all of the things that we're so fascinated with, I think, globally today, We're seeing so much more of that here in our area, where people are really trying their best to keep these things alive, because it's not only is it fun, but they have a real sense of wanting to do it. And here, that's your life. Kathy, we're going to take a quick break, if you don't mind. Would you stay over the break with us so we can talk about some of these medieval Christmas celebrations and menus?
I'd be delighted.
We'd appreciate that. Y'all, don't you dare go anywhere. We're going to be back in just a second. You won't want to miss any of this.
Hello, I'm Georges Collinet. This week on Afropop Worldwide, Rumba para Bebo. Before the great Cuban pianist Bebo Valdez died in March at the age of 94, he said, "Don't cry when I'm gone. Play my music, eat chocolates, drink rum." They did it, and Afropop Worldwide was there. A Rumba for Bebo, this week on Afropop Worldwide from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday night at 8 on KRVS.
Hi, everyone. This is Pat Mitchell-Worley. And coming up next time on Bill Street Caravan, we've got Mingo Fishtrap and the Monophonics, two young soul acts that we really think you're going to like. We'll also hear from our feature host, Adam Hill, as he continues his series, Made in Memphis. That's all coming up next time on Bill Street Caravan.
Tonight at 11 on KRVS.
Comics avec Val. Bienvenue dans le monde francophone. C'est tous les jeudis à 9h sur KRVS, la radio Acadie.
You're listening to KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, and on the web at krvs.org. Find us on Facebook at KRVS Public Media.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose.
Welcome back, y'all, to Stirring It Up, the best tasting food and culture show on radio. And today we're so pleased to have with us Kathy Kaufman, author, professional chef, and chairman of the Culinary Historians of New York. And Michelle, during the break you were talking about medieval banquets you wish you could have attended, or the Symphony on the Hill at White Oak when we did the Hunt Symphony with the shotguns doing the and the symphony played across the lake as the hunters rode in on horses and blowing their hunting bugles. And you said, "Kathy, seen that before?"
I haven't seen it, but I wish I'd been a fly buzzing around those horses.
Oh, my gosh. We love trying to capture some of those historic menus, and they're not always easy to find. You know, a lot of times the historic menus are in private collections, or you might have thousands of, say, Antoine's menus, and only one or two of the kind of off-the-beaten-path restaurants or taverns that may have existed. But we love having those menus and love recreating when we can some of those historic dinners, as John was mentioning. But talking about different dinners, we really need to be talking about Christmas here and what a menu might have been like for a medieval feast at Christmas.
Well, I think the first thing you need to keep in mind is that it's going to be a huge, huge amount of food and all sorts of varieties of food. Certainly at Christmas time, it's winter, it's game season, so you would almost without question have a wild boar that had been roasted. You would certainly have venison. Keep in mind that during the medieval times, there were a lot more birds that were eaten than we certainly do today. So on a royal or aristocratic menu, you would have things like roasted swan and egret. There might be some porpoise on the menu as well. That was something that was eaten. One of the most difficult things about figuring out exactly what was served is they tend to list all of the meats and fishes and almost nothing else. So So it's as if people, if you just read the menu literally, never had vegetables, never had grain dishes, or very, very few grain dishes. And that doesn't seem to be correct. I think it was assumed that these foods would be served, and you didn't mention them. And you just wrote down the high-prestige items. But something really fun and very typical would be a stuffed roasted peacock. And what you would do is you would skin the bird and be very careful to keep the tail feathers intact, roast the bird. You would sterilize the inside by treating it with some salt and, you know, other things, and then put the bird back into its skin with the feathers, and that would be paraded into the dining area as one of the kind of penultimate dishes. And if you were really good, you stuck a rag in the bird's mouth soaked in camphor and then lit it, so it would be a fire-breathing peacock coming in.
Now, talk about presentation.
Really, major presentation. Now, rumor has it that peacock is kind of a nasty-tasting bird. So there are actually, in one of the cookbooks, there is a discussion by the chef that if you agree in advance with your lord, you will substitute a pheasant or something else for the peacock because it's actually much better tasting.
Now, you know, when we see some of these, whether it's a film on Vatel or one of the great cooks, and they're following royalty around and they have with them just a massive amount of food and wagons and musicians and, of course, all of the artists who are putting up the walls for the outdoor gardens and dining rooms and, oh, my God, the food that's coming in and people sourcing food. Is this really what it was like?
Oh, absolutely. I think the Vatel movie was extremely realistic in terms of what an incredible organizational feat it was to pull off one of these movies. I will share with you my favorite late medieval, early Renaissance cookbook, which was by a French chef, Maître Chicard, and he is writing in 1420. And what I love about his cookbook is that the first 30 or 40 pages are instructions about how you organize a great feast. And among the things he tells you is that if you are going to do this, and you need to assume that the feast is going to last 3 days because people are coming from all over to visit with your great lord, you need to source your wooden spits for roasting, and he gives specifications about the type of wood it should be, or better yet, metal, because wood can burn and collapse. You need to arrange for folks in the area, your local farmers and various purveyors, to get the foods for you. And the thing that really gets me is that at the end of the feast, the Lord may decide to extend it for another day. So you need to have a supply of horsemen and horses to go running out to get more food if the feast goes for another day.
Oh, my gosh.
That movie just so intrigued, I'm sure, every cook, every chef, every caterer who ever sat to watch that movie, Vatel. Wow, I either would have loved to be there or am I so thankful I wasn't.
Well, I mean, poor Vatel ends up committing suicide because the fish is feast is going to be a disaster without the fish. And then, of course, as he's dying, the fish trucks show up. Wagon trains show up. It's just tragic.
You mentioned metal spits. You mentioned that the chef wrote about the type of wood on spits. Any references other than, say, rotisseries about equipment or appliances, let's speak of, tools of these grand banquets, anything that you found extremely interesting?
Well, when you are looking at the medieval feasts, I mean, you've seen the illustrations, say, in the Books of Hours of kitchens, and you've basically got an open hearth with a cauldron and spits for roasting. There are the various spit jacks that get developed a bit later on, and they will allow the spits to turn automatically. But, of course, before that, you had boys or dogs who were running around turning the spits. As you move a little bit further through time, as you get to the Renaissance, there some wonderful descriptions of cooking equipment in the Italian books. There's a very famous one by a guy named Scoppi who has, I think, what are the first woodcut illustrations of cooking equipment in a cookbook. And he has things like rolling pins. He has these stoves that we would call potagers, where you have a surface in which you would put pots and have a charcoal fire underneath so you can moderate the temperature. But these potager stoves are not something that you saw a lot of in the medieval period. They actually existed in ancient Rome. If you travel to Pompeii, you see a similar sort of clay stove where you can put a fire beneath and put pots into them and have different temperatures adjusted through the height of the pots. But it's really not until the Renaissance that we start to see greater illustrations of the different sorts of cooking equipment, all the different knives, and even the fork that would be used in the kitchen.
One of my great loves, and at the same time, one of my greatest distractions, is antique culinary equipment. As I travel, I continue to enhance my own collection, and one day we'll all be displayed over at the Chef John Falls Culinary Institute at Nicholls State University. But I'm constantly in search of not only great pieces from these periods when they come up for auction, or when you're touring somebody's great houses out there, and whether it's cutlery or whether it's some of the spitjacks or the hasteners or things like that. I'm so intrigued with the banquets and the food that were cooked on those. I'm thinking to myself, not only had it to be, I'm sure, great cuisine and great food being prepared at the hands of these cooks, but it must have been magical to walk into it and just kind of see it all working and turning and people working in that style of the day. I'm always intrigued by it.
We've talked a fair amount about food, but what about beverages during some of these Christmas dinners? We drink wine with Christmas dinner today, but what would have been the spirit of choice then?
Well, if you were rich enough, it would have been wine. There was certainly a great wine trade going on between France and England during the Middle Ages. So if you had the money, you drank wine. If the wine was not quite up to par, what you would do is you would doctor it with some spices and maybe a little sugar or honey, and then it would taste a lot better. If you didn't have the money for that, you would be drinking beer or ale, or you might be drinking ciders or perries. The one thing you wouldn't be drinking would be water. There were concerns about the water supply, so you would not be drinking.
That would kill you faster than the wine, for sure.
Actually, you would often dilute the wine with water, and the alcohol in the wine would help kill off any nasties in the water, but that was always a concern. And then the wine also, or you know, virtually any of your alcoholic drinks had certain health promoting benefits, or were believed to, under the doctrine of humoral medicine. And water just wasn't going to do it for you if you subscribed to humoral medicine, and that was the preeminent dietary theory of the time. So in fact, some of the great lords and ladies would have their physicians attending the feast, not only because they were important members of the royal household, but because the doctors would be there to say, well, you're looking a little tired today, so I would recommend you eat these sorts of foods for these reasons.
Kathy, so what are you working on now? Do you have any interesting projects that you're diving into?
Oh, I've got two projects, actually, right now. One is, like Chef John, I love the material culture of cooking and dining, and I have been working on a book about the material culture of the dining room itself. So the plates, the glasses, the utensils, that sort of thing. That's a long-term project, and I hope to have it done reasonably soon, but can't promise that. And then I'm also working with a colleague of mine. We are going to be doing another encyclopedia of food and drink, but this one is going to focus on New York City exclusively.
What a fabulous project.
Oh, we're looking forward to it tremendously. We just got the go-ahead on it. So it'll be a couple of years down the road, but we will have another book that's tentatively entitled Savoring Gotham.
Oh, wow. That sounds awesome. Great title. Great title.
Now, we had mentioned that we're going to be in New York in the coming weeks. Are there any culinary or food museums that you would recommend that we not miss during our few days there?
Well, certainly there are often good programs at the Museum of Natural History. And in fact, I think they've got one on poison that just opened up that should be interesting. The Museum of the City of New York is doing a program on Gilded Age New York, and they are going to be doing some things on material culture. I'll be actually doing a little program for them in January on how to set a proper Gilded Age dining table. Mm. And then you should always look into MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. That's kind of a peripatetic place. It's more of a virtual existence, but they often have things. And then finally, the Tenement Museum in New York down on Orchard Street, which is talking about 19th century life in New York, and it has several different food exhibitions, so that might be a good place to go.
That's awesome. Well, and I hope that we'll get to visit with you during one of our visits, if not this one, the next. But it's been a pleasure to have you with us on the show today. I'm sorry we don't have more time, because goodness knows we could.
We could chat forever.
We could.
Well, Kathy, let me say a very happy holidays to you, and thanks so much for your great contribution to our world of food and drink. And I will be sending you some things to just add to your library. But at the same time, please, please, please come and visit us in Louisiana. There's so much going on here.
Oh, I love the food in New Orleans. You don't have to ask me twice.
Well, our new restaurant, Revolution, opened in New Orleans. Rick Tramado and I opened it a year ago, and it pays homage to the seven nations that created the rich cuisine and culture we call Creole. So you need to come in and see what we're doing menu-wise and also artifact-wise. A lot of wonderful exhibits within the restaurant. The restaurant Revolution in New Orleans. Come by and see us, okay?
I would love to, and happy holidays to you both.
Thank you so
you
much.
Too. Thank
and y'all,
you.
We could have gone on for another hour with
oh
Kathy.
Oh, my
right
gosh. She's, interesting.
Well, she's our subject. We love it so much. Anyway, what about books, Michelle?
Well, I'd like to suggest this book, Christmas Feasts from History. It was written by Lorna Sass as part of the Great American Cooking School series of books. Lorna takes us on a historic journey of Christmas celebrations, starting with the Roman Saturnalia banquet through a Victorian Christmas dinner. Each chapter is prefaced with a short historic narrative about Christmas feasts of that era and is followed by a typical menu of the day. Fabulous book. The next book I think you would like, Food, the History of Taste by Paul Friedman. It's a book that we turn to often in doing our historical work. Beautifully illustrated coffee table book. Comprehensive chronological history of taste from prehistory to the present day. And I want to remind everybody that we will have the Encyclopedia of Cajun and Creole Cuisine. It is now available in an e-format, electronic versions. So if you have a Kindle, if you have a Nook, if you have any of these electronic readers, we have the encyclopedia ready for
and
you.
And y'all, three great recipes on the website, jfalls.com. Just go to our Facebook page, too, facebook.com/stirringitup. It's all right there for you. Happy holidays, y'all. Merry Christmas.
Voices from the past, wishes for the present, and hopes for the future. We celebrate the season on the Thistle and Shamrock. I hope you'll join us.
Coming up Sunday evening at 6, here on KRVS.
Essa moça.
This week on La Bayonera, we feature the new sounds of Brazil, music inspired by the greats of the Tropicália movement. It's got a dance party potential, so tune in Thursday at 11 p.m. till the midnight hour, only here on KRVS 88.7 FM.
Hi, this is Helen Forster. Please join us this week for our special holiday program featuring an award about a woman who's helping children stay warm in the chilly winters of Chicago. We'll also be visited by Mark O'Connor and Matt Wirtz for some Christmas music for you all. That's this week in E-Town.
Tuesday at noon on KRVS.
You're listening to KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, a public service of the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Find us on Facebook at KRVS Public Media.
Le rendez-vous des Cadiens du Théâtre Liberté à Unis est rendu possible en partie par Le Best Stop Supermarket de Scott.
Underwriting for